This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and a very happy new year to you. We thought, maybe like us, you have eaten well, but possibly not too wisely, and you feel it's time for a wee bit of personal reconfiguration. If so, we are here to help with a pretty healthy blast of fresh air.
I had a spiritual experience when I was working in one of the gardens here. I was just weeding some kale, and I went into an altered state of consciousness.
There's this huge hunger amongst people to reconnect. 1.5 million years of doing it one way. Even if you don't know that's what you want, that's a draw.
We used to know all the names of the trees. We used to use them. We used to plant round trees out the front of our house to keep evil spirits away. And we used to plant elder trees out the back to keep flies away. And we used to have a holly tree planted as well to protect us from lightning strikes.
We come to you this morning from the banks of the River Dee in Aberdeenshire. And my fellow portly woodland elf this morning, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
I don't know, I had high hopes of losing weight at Christmas.
Why? Why would you think that?
Blind optimism, but we do have a roaring fire here. In amongst quite an interesting collection of trees, some dead, some looking fantastic, yeah. And right at a wee bend in the River Dee, which is looking really full, and we're well and truly out of doors.
What surprised me is how quiet it is. It's so high up into the sort of, you know, the soft grass of the banks, you're not hearing any sort of burbling or gurgling.
Rather than hitting all the rocks as it goes down.
Yeah, something like that.
It's quite a gentle sort of calming effect.
Well, the great thing about this time of year is, irrespective of the weather, and it was raining quite heavily just basically about half an hour ago, you just feel so much better when you get outside. You know, after the sort of 2 weeks of waddlesome sloth, it's time to get out there and actually shake a leg.
Well, a lot of people go and do the Christmas Day walk or the New Year's walk. And I think there is a reason for that. Most people think it's just to kind of work off the apathy and the calories, but I think it's deeper than that. There's that sense of getting outside, get away from the cabin fever. If you get a blast of sunlight, it's just a real bonus. That clear sky, the sun shafting down really low in the sky, and it's just like charging a battery. You go, drink it in.
And how often across the last 12 months of 2019 did we hear folks saying how important it was to actually reconnect with nature?
Yeah, we've been speaking to some fascinating people who've actually taken the time to reconnect. And in some cases, you've probably met some as well, it's literally changed somebody's life. Yeah. So much so, he's becoming really evangelical about it. Saying, you know, come with me into the great outdoors and you will be better.
Come and join us. We need a brass band. Our first contributor in this programme is a lady called Monica Wilde. Now, fascinating woman. She's a research herbalist, a forager, an ethnobotanist. She's got an incredible knowledge of plants, flowers, trees, seaweed, fungus, you name it. But she also uses them medicinally and as food. I went to meet her at her house in West Lothian, where we just wandered about her garden for a while.
I tend to have an approach that's more about stewarding or shepherding the plants, not what I would call gardening. So you can see that there's been some areas where we've just been doing a bit of land movement, really creating habitats so that the plants can get on with it themselves.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of thing are you growing? Or trying to encourage, not growing?
I'm really trying to encourage plants that have both an edible and a medicinal use. And preferably the wild ones, because then they look after themselves. Uh-huh. You know, you don't have to do any weeding when you've got good weeds.
True. Okay, so what good weeds have you got?
Well, look, there's some hedge garlic. Mm-hmm. It's come up a little bit early already, but see there, have a taste of that.
Okay.
Sometimes called garlic mustard, sometimes called hedge mustard, sometimes called jack by the hedge.
That's nice.
Is this, isn't it?
Peppery. Garlic, without a doubt. But, yeah, it's got a nutty taste to it, too. I like that.
Yeah, and a lot of them are sort of quite pungent and a little bit bitter at this time of year. Mm-hmm. Of course, in the spring, they come up in a much more tender,
much sweeter. And of course, nowadays, most supermarket vegetables have been bred to be very, very sweet. Look, there's some early comfrey coming up.
Mm-hmm.
This is tuberous comfrey, which is very, very common in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always a lot of controversy about comfrey because it contains something called pyrrolizidine alkaloids, which aren't very good for your liver in large doses.
Okay.
But this one actually has very, very little to very few at all. So it's probably the safest out of all the comfreys. And I use this to make ratatouille, to make fritters sometimes.
Uh-huh.
You'll feel it. It's a little bit rough on the side,
yeah.
So definitely improved by cooking, because that roughness then disappears.
I have a vague memory that, was it comfrey root that used to be used as an early form of plaster of Paris?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So comfrey's really good. Comfrey's nickname was Knitbone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very good for helping bones to grow together, helping to repair connective tissue. It has an action on the collagen under your skin.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever there's been tendon damage, for instance, I pulled my Achilles tendon a couple of years ago, and every now and again after a long walk or drive, it really plays up. And I'll get some root if it's the autumn, or just the leaf if it's the summer. Bash it up a bit, because mm-hmm. when you bash up a plant, and it always releases the enzymes which create the medicinal compounds, and put it in a foot bath. And you'll be amazed at how quickly you feel better again
right.
after that. It really takes down the pain, the swelling, and you know, seems to put the strength back in it. I mean, when I was a kid, my aunt used to basically get a couple of leaves, bash them with a rolling pin, put them between some gauze, and then bandage them onto your twisted ankle or whatever it was.
How did you get into this?
Well, I've always had a love affair with plants, specifically. Fungi came later, but plants specifically, ever since I was a little girl. I grew up in Kenya, so from the age of 6 or 7, we were outdoors pretty much all the time. I was the eldest of 5 children, so I quickly learnt that as long as I turned up for meals, nobody
much cared.
Nobody, you know, my mother was so busy with so many children that I don't actually remember ever being on my own with her.
Yeah,
you know, we were on the edge of a farm. There were loads of kids on the farm. I used to run around with the kids, and one of the old ladies on the farm was a Kikuyu herbalist who'd send us out to go and get plants for her. She was getting a bit old and rickety. And we just had free roam of the place.
How did she do that? I mean, obviously, once you know what the plant is, then you can go and get it. But prior to that stage, did she give you an example of the plant and say, go and find more of this?
Yes, she would. Well, sometimes some of the older children would already know what she was talking about. But if nobody knew what she was talking about, she'd lift up her mattress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the huts are quite dark, you know, because there's not electricity in that. And she'd lift up the mattress off her sort of cot bed, and then underneath, between some layers of flattened cardboard box, would be plants.
Yeah.
And she'd show you what it looked like. And then there were the instructions, you know, go down the river, past the bit where the cattle cross, you know, 3 rocks down, there's a rock that looks like an elephant behind that. You know? So we'd go off, dam up the river,
uh-huh.
you know, spend a couple of hours damming up the river, poking sticks into snake holes and termite mounds, and then yeah. eventually remember we were supposed to be getting a plant.
Ah, yes.
You know, or going into... I remember there was this place where there were all these, like, mulberry trees, and below it, what we called Cape gooseberries,
mm-hmm.
which were sort of like little... They looked like little Chinese lanterns with
yeah.
these very sort of sour fruits inside. And quite a lot of the plants... I think, you know, something that reminds me of what chickweed is now
mm-hmm.
would grow in between them. You know, so we'd go off to get them and then start stuffing our faces with berries and completely forget what we were supposed to be doing. But eventually take them back, and she'd sort of boil up some revolting potion for some poor member of the village.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly enough, in African medicine, they don't just treat the illness. You know, they treat the illness and the person and their spirit and the community. Sometimes part of your cure is an instruction to the community.
Uh-huh.
That's something we've lost.
Absolutely. How did you go from that, though, to, I don't know how to describe it, Western herbal medicine? I don't know.
Well, there is a tradition called the Western herbal medicine tradition, and it was very strong in Scotland with the Macbeths. And so,
who were the Macbeths?
They were the sort of herbalist physicians to royalty. Really, so they were a long line, a family of healers that would pass the traditions on to their sons, and then their sons' sons and daughters, yeah. presumably, as well. There would have been lots of families like that, but because they were sort of royal physicians, they were recorded in a lot of the sort of history books, whereas most of your, you know, wise women who came out from behind a hedge didn't make the written books.
Yeah. It's interesting how often it was women, though.
It was often women who were targeted for burning in witchcraft trials and things. But no, a lot of the herbalists were men. Mm. And still are.
Monica Wilde there. Really interesting what she was saying about the African medicine. You know, where she started off, where you are treating the individual, you're treating the illness, you're treating the spirits, you're treating the community at the same time. That's something that wouldn't cross our minds, I don't think.
Can it make sense to a certain extent? Because if you've got a malaise from your environment, whether it's, you know, a lack of space or other things going on in your life, there's a reasonable chance the whole community's suffering from that, especially maybe provision of green spaces. The whole community benefits, and it just makes sense, because if one person's suffering, there's a fair chance some of your neighbours will be as well.
Yeah. Now, the next two people we're speaking to here, I don't think they're suffering in the slightest. They seem to be having a whale of a time. You met them at the Nature of Scotland Awards.
They grabbed life by the horns. It's just incredible. Sandra Beer and Lynn Cassells of Lynbreck Croft near Grattan and Spey, they won the Food and Farming Award recently at that RSPB ceremony, but they've won almost everything in Scotland, because their approach to life is so refreshing, so exciting. And there's a whole movement coming with them, and there's a bit of a theme here. They are revolutionising a lot of aspects of farming.
What I like about it is they're doing it on a relatively small scale. They're trying to, as they put it themselves, work in harmony with nature. Fair enough, you've heard lots of people say that in the past, in order to produce food. But they're actually trialling methods which were used by previous generations. Now, back in May, I visited the Croft, which is a really beautiful location overlooking the Cairngorms, and Sandra gave me the grand tour.
This has been a croft for centuries. So what you're looking at down there would have been the old croft house and the croft garden, surrounded by some fields that would have been cultivated at some point, probably neeps and tatties and the like, and then just went back to pasture and stayed like that for quite a number of years until we bought the place.
Behind the trees and behind the croft, you've got moorland, and then you've got coniferous plantation, and then behind that you've got the Cairngorms. And the sun is shining on the summits today, the snow covered, cloud passing over them. Can't be many more dramatic locations to have a croft in Scotland than this.
I agree. It's absolutely stunning. You do get days when you've got blizzards coming in.
I can't believe that for a moment. I'm sure the weather's always perfect here.
I like to tell you, yes.
Can we have a shift around the croft? I mean, tell me about it. What is it you're doing?
Well, we're in the middle of trying to build a wee crofting business that we can live from eventually. It's a very diversified business. So as you can see, we've got some Highland cattle here. We've got hens living in a mobile house. We've got some sheep. We've got some pigs. We've got bees. And what we want here is for all the animals to be part of a team to help look after the land and improve it in a natural way.
Explain that, because it's just stated baldly that it does sound a wee bit Walt Disney.
It does. But what's at the core of our business and our life here is nature. So we want to work with it, because we think by working with it, our animals will benefit, we'll benefit health-wise and financially as well, because you can't work against the environment, you have to work with it. So this is why we've chosen animals that can survive in this climate. They thrive in this climate. They're allowed to mature slowly, because eventually they will go into the food chain. But that way we can produce the healthiest of produce of meat.
The great thing about Highland coos particularly is, I mean, you show them a photograph of grass and they'll put on weight.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, actually, they don't need this lush green grass. They're happy to live out on the moor. They're happy to live out on really rough land, which is what we've got a lot of. It's a typical croft from that point of view. It's not prime agricultural land. It's rough and ready.
I was very, very taken by your woodshed too. I've never seen that design before, but boy, that's clever.
I mean, it looks very pretty, but there is definitely a practical background to that as well. So originally, when we thought we need somewhere to dry out all the firewood, we told our joiner about this, and he said, well, I mean, where you live, you know, snow and rain comes in horizontally, so, which is why he built a louvered wood store.
I saw these leaning up against the wall, and essentially what you've got is just battens with a triangle taken out every so often. I'd say it's about a foot apart, roughly. And what that means is you can actually put the wood slanted up against that, and you end up, it's like a big louver door, but it's the entire side of the shed.
Yeah.
So the rain can't get in, but the wind can.
Exactly.
It's brilliant.
Air circulation is spot on. And so we've had a really good drying season and had lovely wood to burn all winter. And like I said, it's really important for us to have that, mm-hmm. because that's all we use to heat our house is firewood.
Yeah, you've got to have the right kind of firewood.
Absolutely. Tree hay. Now that's
somebody told me about tree hay this morning. I'd never heard of it before.
Right. Well, funnily enough, it's a really, really old technique of feeding animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially the same idea as normal grass hay. You cut branches off trees in summer, you bundle them up, and then you dry them and feed it out as tree hay in winter.
How thick are the branches?
Not too thick. It'll be all the new growth that you want, mm-hmm. with all the leaves on. And what it gives the animals is obviously a bit of supplement. And for us, it's really important because we buy in our grass hay, and it's a lot of cost. We can't produce it ourselves. But it also means that animals have access to different kind of nutrients, even throughout the winter when there aren't tree leaves to munch on. And what we know is that trees, by the very way they grow with their roots penetrating deep into the ground, they have access to different nutrients and minerals that grass doesn't. And we did notice our animals always made a beeline for tree leaves over beautiful lush grass.
Mm-hmm.
So it means they're obviously getting something from those leaves that they're not getting from the grass.
So I'm slightly distracted. I thought I was getting tinnitus, but you've obviously got wind chimes.
We've
across
got wind there. Chimes.
Yeah, okay.
It keeps us all calm in stressful situations.
Of which there are many, 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 many. I can see stuff that you've planted here, you know, a couple of birch trees and and I don't know if that's possibly ash or sycamore, and then you've got some willow there.
Yes.
How many trees have you planted in total?
We're approaching 30,000 trees.
Wow.
On the croft.
How big's the croft?
It's 150 acres, so it's a fair size,
right,
for a croft.
Okay.
We went into what you call a woodland creation scheme. We planted, mm-hmm. over 17,000 trees of new woodland. We've enriched our existing woodland with different species, all native broadleaves and a bit of pine. We've created new hedgerows.
Where? I ask that because it looks like quite an open landscape to me.
It's all there when you take a closer look. You can see the beginning of the hedgerow,
mm-hmm.
in between those two fences.
Oh, yeah.
If you turn around and look this way, the hill in behind the croft house,
uh-huh.
That's where the 17,500 trees went in. So those trees are only 2 years old. They're maybe about this tall, but they're starting to show.
Yeah.
And they're
40, 50 centimetres, something like that.
Yeah, they're starting to shoot up now.
Where's the prevailing wind come from?
Would be the south and southwest.
Okay.
So the winds come straight off the cairngorms and
so
hit us.
So some idiots put the hill and the trees in the wrong place.
Yeah, it wasn't designed very well. That's the thing. We have the best view out to the south, looking at the mountains, but that's exactly where the wind comes from as well. So you have to find the balance of open view and a bit of shelter. We wouldn't want to sacrifice the view, so we'll put up with a bit of wind for now, I think.
Is there a sense here that, you know, this is a legacy project?
I think you could be right with that. And that, obviously, when you're talking about things like tree planting, we'll not see this woodland, you know, as a mature woodland. We'll be long gone by then. But
mm-hmm.
knowing it's there, and whoever takes this croft on after us will have something very special to work with. That is a good thought. And that's what gives us the energy to just go out and do it all. It's a long-term game. Definitely.
What is it you've got down there? Because there's almost, I can see black Highland cattle down there, but what is it you've actually got? There's like a little wooden enclosure.
So we were talking about the tree hay earlier,
mm-hmm.
and that's where we grow our tree hay, is in those, we've got 10 wooden copses, about 10 by 10 metres.
Okay.
And each copse contains about 350 trees, so they're planted very densely.
It's what almost, kind of trees?
It's all alder and willow, two different kinds of willow.
Is willow not a problem? Because, I mean, willow's got salicylic acid in it. Our horses love willow.
Right.
But, you know, too much of it might not be a good thing.
Definitely all things in moderation, but it mm-hmm. is one of the things that animals will use to self-medicate
mm-hmm.
when needed because of the salicylic acid and the
I reckon they use it when they don't need it. They just like
well,
it, you know.
Yeah, but giving the animals the choice, I think, is beneficial. The same with alder. We know it contains tannins, and tannins are a natural antiparasitic.
Mm-hmm.
So it means it can reduce worm burdens in a natural way. So it's all things that we're trialling. If it works, then great. If it doesn't, we still have great shelter down there for the animals and a very open, exposed spot.
And the idea about planting them so closely, presumably, is to encourage vertical growth. You don't want it to thicken or spread, you want it up.
That's it. We'll let them grow like that for a few years, and then we coppice them, which means we'll cut them right down to the ground. And they're all tree species that coppice quite happily. They'll shoot back again in no time. You see a fence line down there between the moor and our field, and we've planted an edible hedge in there. So that's, again, three different kinds of willow. And we can cut sections out and feed it to the animals in summer fresh, or just use it as shelter, or they can browse on it when they're down there.
This is a statement from the Academy of the Blindingly Obvious, but so much of what you're doing is harking back to what used to happen 150, 200 years ago.
I suppose back in the old days, people just had to work with what they had. They didn't have a lot of machinery back then. There wasn't a lot of artificial input, so they worked with what was naturally available. And I know we don't really want to go backwards in time. We want to look to the future, but sometimes things were done for a good reason back in the old days. And I think we're starting to see that we have to go back to working with the environment to make this a long-term game for everyone and everything.
Sandra Baer there, who farms the award-winning Lynbrook Croft with Linker Cells near Granton-on-Spey.
I keep on popping them up with almost everything I've been to this year, whether it's an award ceremony or getting more women to think about agriculture or forestry as a career or crofting. They are everywhere. And people love it because they've, as I said before, they've embraced it. They're trying a lot of different things. I'd never heard of treelage before. That was a new one on me.
No, this idea of tree hay. But apparently it's an old thing that used to happen. I had never heard it before. I've asked quite a few people in the horsey world if they heard it, and no, they haven't. So where they came up with it, I don't know.
But they're, you know, they're big online. They've got a huge following. And people are coming to the Croft just for a tour to see the way they operate. And it's really quite inspiring that two folk who weren't hugely knowledgeable about farming to start with, have just really gone for it. You're moving away from me because
we have a
massive fire in front of us.
That's one of the reasons I'm moving away from you. We've got a fire here by the banks of the Dee, and I was going to, pardon me.
Okay, why does smoke always? We've got a 360-degree track around this fire.
Quiet. And wherever we go, the smoke follows us.
But there is a lovely-looking thing there, a tripod with a trapeze hanging underneath it.
Right. We're going like to a cook. Skillet type thing.
We've got
sausages.
Yep.
We have sausages. Do you want to give us a hand lifting this over?
Right.
I'll get rid of this.
There's a pulley on it as well that looks like you can adjust it.
You can basically lower it down and up. That I like.
So does that mean we won't get burnt sausages this week?
No, we won't get burnt sausages. Well, no, that's not true, actually. I'm sorry, I can't actually see anything because I'm blinded by the smoke.
Yeah, we are embracing...
I am cooking the sausages. Therefore, we're pretty well doomed to get burnt sausages.
Yeah, but we are embracing the outdoors right next to the River Dee in Aberdeenshire. We're about 40, 50 feet from the river. As you said earlier, it's really quiet. It's got a whole sense of power, but it's not quite boiling, and I can't believe the smoke's coming around us.
We are, as you say, surrounded by some very old beech trees. Some of them are thought to be over 300 years old. Now, connecting with trees is something I've come across in people in the past. It's not something I'm particularly good at, but I've met people that I genuinely believe can. One of them is composer Hamish Napier.
Yeah, Hamish lives close to the old Spey Bridge at Granton. It's a fantastic bridge if you get a chance. Take a wee detour at the wee railway restaurant and have a wee look at it. It's just a delightful bridge from the wonderful Anagach Woods. But Hamish wasn't always that intimately connected with the trees and with nature, as Helen discovered.
It used to be for a while that I would look at a patch of forest and go, oh, there's a woods, but now I find myself looking at a patch of woodland and going, oh, there's a line of aspen trees or there's some downy birch, or there's some silver birch, or those are some willows along the river. And it's really lovely noticing all these little characters. I was in Glasgow for 16 years, and I moved back up north, and one of the first things that I did was I went for a wander with a book, and one of the first ones I came across was hawthorn. And I'm embarrassed to say that it's got these really distinctive leaves, but I'm embarrassed to say that I don't think I'd ever really noticed them before. You start to go, wait a minute, this stuff is around me all the time. I also found out that the name for the River Spey, it comes from sort of two names. One of them is like phlegm, because you get all these big white foam things in the whirlpools and all that. But also it gets its name from like a really, really old Celtic Welsh name, which translates as Hawthorn. So it was Hawthorn River. So one of the tracks on the album is an improvisation that I did underneath the Oldsby Bridge, where the echo was great for your flute.
Starting to try and understand the trees more connected you more with the landscape that you were living in.
Yeah, I think you really want to have this idea that people will be more strongly connected with their landscape around about them. I mean, you see it in the news right now with more and more about climate change, and we used to know all the names of the trees. We used to use them. We used to plant round trees out the front of our house to keep evil spirits away, and we used to plant elder trees out the back to keep flies away, and we used to have a holly tree planted as well to protect us from lightning strikes.
Explain that one a bit more. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, so it's a really cool thing. There's some famous castles, like the one at Loch Awe, that burnt down after it getting struck by lightning, and it was a bad thing back in the day with thatched roofs. You know, if you got your place got struck by lightning, it can end up with the whole place going up in flames, and all these prominent buildings are obviously susceptible to lightning strikes. But what people would do is plant a holly tree. So there's a kind of special conductivity due to the spines in the leaves, where it'll just channel the lightning into the earth, and it'll protect itself and everything else around about it. An oak tree usually ends up coming off worse off, or an ash tree. They say that the ash courts a flash. So it was a tree of protection.
We are walking in somewhere that I have always found very inspiring when it comes to trees. We're just on the edge of Loch Inniallen.
If you're ever in Cairngorm National Park and you're wanting to do something for the day, I highly recommend coming to Loch Inniallen. It's this beautiful, tranquil forest loch, and it's surrounded by ancient pine woods, and there's some really beautiful old trees.
Now, the other significant thing about the trees, and something that you've been focusing on, is the Gaelic alphabet.
So I discovered that the Gaelic alphabet was taught to children through the old names for the trees. It's actually one of the things that kickstarted this album, was actually a party at my house. Ian McFarlane from Glenfinnan, he brought round just a wee housewarming present for me when I moved to the Highlands, and it was a wee mug that had this Gaelic alphabet on it. So it's funny, it's like sometimes the best way to start a project is just to have a big party. Therein lies the lesson.
Creative juices flowing. Yeah,
exactly, that's it. Turns out not all the native trees were represented, and they had a few things we don't normally really see an awful lot of in this part of Scotland. Like, we don't really see much ivy, really, or you don't really see any yew in the wild. I kind of tweaked it a bit, the Gaelic alphabet, the trees that I chose. I still use things like cal, which is hazel, and dar, which is oak, but I used other ones as well, like wild rose, for example. And it's just finding a little story about each one. So kind of learning a bit about the properties of the tree and what the uses were. There's a lovely thing I read about rowan, which is particular to Strathspey, and that was that they used to make a big ring of rowan in Strathspey, and they would pass all the cattle through that ring just to kind of bless them. You hear about people attaching wee twigs of rowan onto their tails of their cattle, or attaching them above the mantelpiece and bring them into the house to keep them safe, you know, from evil spirits. The rowan tree is the tree of magic.
Hamish Napier speaking to Helen Needham at Loch Inniallen near Abbey Moor. And that piece, The Tree of Magic, is from Hamish's forthcoming album, The Woods. We'll give you more details on that later, because he's going to be sharing more of the stories he's unearthed during his research into trees. That business of the rowan arch, I've heard of that before.
I've certainly heard of the rowan twigs being put above the doorstep. And if you look at many, many's a croft in Scotland, the walls always have a rowan tree there to keep the spirits away. It's, you know, a lot of people say, what a load of nonsense, but they still carry on doing it. Presumably, It works. And that's from an age when people were much more in tune with their environment, with the elements. And that whole weaving of folklore into their lives is an important part of it, especially when you're at one with nature and you're at the mercy of nature at the same time.
This week, we're actually, Ewan and I, down beside the banks of the Dee in rural Aberdeenshire. And the river's quite full today, but there's something quite calming about it. I always watch fishermen and think, you know, the fishermen make superb naturalists because they're just standing there. They're absorbing a sort of sense of nature.
I can stand here and watch the river, same as I can stand and watch the sea, or be in the woods. I'll sit down for 20 minutes at the base of a tree and just let the mind go. You know, there's nothing constructive there. No. It's just been released into the atmosphere.
Yeah. It's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. It's because, you know, there is so much noise, there's so much sort of jazziness in life nowadays that just the chance to embrace a sense of calm shouldn't be passed up. This is lovely down here, though. Just where we're standing, there's a wee bit of a beach. If I just make my way down into the water, because I've got my wellies on, I'm quite happy.
Take care.
You're kind of stuck, aren't you, because you get the boots on. But ordinarily, the river would be about 20 feet in front of us, where we're standing at the moment. But it's a sort of tea colour, I would say, at the moment.
What's that? Peat, presumably, from further up in the hills. But A, you get that sense of power, and it's not that classic slow-moving river meandering. This stuff is hurtling down towards the sea, which is only a couple of miles down the coast. But when you're in the water, like you are, or you're beside the trees, it's a theme for this whole programme. I maintain when you're with nature, when you're communicating with nature, you feel part of nature. And we're part of that animal. You know, you're sceptical about the trees. We can go and touch some trees later on in the programme.
No, I'm not sceptical about it. I said I'm not very good at doing it myself.
Well, we can try it again later and just see if you can get tap into that energy.
Thomas Miller's based at the Fintorn Foundation near Forest, where he teaches, amongst other things, nature connection courses. And you went to meet him recently.
I would say that I really became aware of it after I got out of the army, moved to the foundation, and realized I had a lot of stress in my body and needed to do something about it.
Why were you stressed?
I was going on foot patrols in Afghanistan and getting shot at sometimes in Iraq. I did 3 deployments total. So my body was really full of adrenaline and cortisol, and my mind was not in fantastic shape when I first arrived.
Say it wasn't in fantastic shape. What kind of place were you in?
I was kind of hyper-vigilant, so everywhere felt dangerous. I noticed I was driving way too fast and taking stupid risks when I was going hiking, like climbing cliffs. And then halfway up, I'd be like, why am I here? I'm not having fun anymore. Why do I seek out stress? But I was.
So what about the outdoors? Why did you decide that that might be a route out of the stress?
I had a spiritual experience when I was working in one of the gardens here. I was just weeding some kale, and I went into an altered state of consciousness, and I was connecting with the kale's consciousness. And when I came out, I was a different person. My body felt different, sort of my inner state felt different, and then I went back to how I was with changes from that, but I realized that there's whole other dimensions, which Fintorn has explored very extensively, that were really capable of transforming how I was.
There will be folk listening saying, communicating with kale, how does that work? How does that feel?
Yeah, fair enough. So it was completely new for me, but it was a sense of being in tune with a consciousness very different from mine, but capable of somehow interacting with me. It felt like we could actually meet in a loving way and in this other realm. And it's really hard to come up with words. I'm not doing a very good job here, probably. But
it's a difficult concept to explain.
Yeah, but the experience was something that I couldn't doubt. And talking to guests here, which I do a lot of people say, I go into nature and, you know, okay, so normal stuff happens, but there's something much deeper there. And when we get to that place, then words are often quite difficult.
Is that a scary moment or is that a kind of euphoria moment?
It was neither, I would say. It was realizing that I have this whole potential within myself that I had never previously accessed, and I was accessing it. So it was more like an exploration moment and a moment of realizing the world is different than I thought it was.
So did you find your mind was changing gear?
I certainly did, yes, absolutely. I mean, for one thing, my adrenaline, my cortisol were going way down, and I was being able to sort of relate to people in life more normally. But in another way, I realized that when I was in the forest walking around or hiking or what have you, my senses were getting more clear, more precise, and my mind, so my subvocalization, this is a technical term from performance psychology, but the voice in my head was sometimes just disappearing. And instead of that, I would have a really rich, full, deep awareness of like body sensations, my sense of like, you know, okay, here it feels more energetic, here it feels less energetic. It was just richer and fuller and way more relaxed.
You say relaxed. Has it not got the potential to be much more stressful if you're commuting with kale and you've developed that whole sense? You know, here we are in the woods. It's not everything shouting at you.
Yeah, no, it's a completely different state. So if it was acting like a human and having to talk to me in words, that would be one thing. But, I mean, just think about how it is to be with a human you love. You don't need to be saying something, but there's a presence there. You can feel your presence. You can feel their presence. There's some kind of exchange between you, you know. Let's say you've built a lot of love for this person. That just their presence is going to do something to you. And now I'm much more aware when I walk in the woods, okay, these things around me, they're alive. They're sentient in some way. And I can sense that presence. Sometimes information comes through that. But usually it's just a sense of shared presence. And me, I have a felt sense in my body of being actually larger, expanding out through the space and sort of being more aware of things.
The change in you, was that physical or was it mainly mental?
It was all sorts of things. There was certainly a physical component. Like I said, adrenaline, cortisol, you know, went way down and I started regulating my stress hormones much better. But there was also my mental style was very different. Like I said, subvocalization or using an inner mental dialogue or voice in my head, that's actually not a very good way to go about life. They've done lots of studies on that in performance psychology. So my inner style changed. I was more aware of sensation, more aware of impressions and more precise about what parts of those impressions were sort of relevant to me. If you can think about talking in your head versus experiencing life in a very direct way, that's kind of what was going on in me. And that was mental, but it was also other things as well.
So that's great for you, a good place to be. But you're quite evangelical about it. You're trying to spread the word out to a bigger community.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right about that. Maybe I'm too evangelical at times. But I've also heard...
Well, nothing to apologize about enjoying the outdoors. I mean, that's fantastic.
Exactly. And I also talk with a lot of people who say, I work on a computer or what have you. My life is kind of... It feels empty somehow. I feel like my body's drained all the time. So if I am a bit evangelical, it's because I see how reconnecting being in nature is. And simply walking and paying attention to your senses, you know, being open to, you know, feeling the presence of trees and so on. I can see how it changes so many people who come to the foundation, and I imagine it's, you know, it's obviously true all over the world, so that's why I want to share this.
Thomas Miller, a fascinating guy. Later he's going to be offering some practical advice on how to de-stress in the outdoors.
Yeah, I'm going to be upfront about this, because his talk about being on foot patrol in Afghanistan and Iraq must make you incredible. I can't even come close to imagine what that's like. But when he said... the kale started communicating with him. You go, oh.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But just what, you know, you accept it, buy into it, working for him. Yeah, I'm with him. I see no problem with it. We've got beech tree here.
Mm-hmm.
Big old beech tree. Now, I don't know what the rules are here, but just close my eyes, put my hand in it. Whether you're communicating with the tree, but you can feel your heartbeat,
mm-hmm.
you can feel the senses all around you. So, potentially in time, you might get in communication with the tree, but I would argue just by doing this, putting your hand on the tree and closing your eyes, you're getting more in tune with yourself, which has got to be a good thing.
I'm not sure the tree's necessary. I think you could probably just stand still and do exactly the same thing, or sit down and
see, I disagree with you there.
Okay.
When you're standing like that, you're concentrating more on balancing your feet, staying upright. And the simple act, I mean, you have to stay a point. Simple act of leaning against the tree, you're more relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
When there will be a lot of people saying, oh, they finally lost it now.
They've cracked it, that's it. They've actually tipped right over the edge. This tree actually sits on Helen Needham's mother's farm. Tell us about these trees. What do you know about them?
Well, I know that some of them are over 300 years old, so mm-hmm. they're very, very old beech trees. You can see that they're big, tall things that have been here for a long time. But in recent years, we've started to lose some. You see behind you there,
yeah.
There's one that's gone.
And basically, it's the whole top of this thing has fallen off.
Yeah, and that's been happening about one every year for the past few years. And we think that's a result of a fungus that's actually affecting the root.
Right.
Do you know anything about this fungus?
Well, only funnily enough, what your partner, Tomás, told me. It's called Kretschmaria. It's black, it's slightly crusty, it's odd-looking stuff, but it doesn't do it any good at all. You know, and apparently it's not just beech trees it affects, it's birch trees as well.
I was pretty fascinated to hear what forager and herbalist Monica Wild had to say about the possibility of cultivating the right sort of fungus and mycelium around trees.
I've been inoculating a lot of the things.
How do you inoculate?
For instance, down the side here, you can see this hedge. There's still a few red berries left from the crampark, which are very bitter. And this I call a medicinal hedge because it provides both food for the birds with hawthorn berries, crampark berries. There's some rose in there for hips and things. Mm-hmm. But they're all wild edibles or medicinal species. About 90% of plants have a mycorrhizal association with fungi. They need fungi to be able to grow. And if you want things to grow quite fast, it's a really good idea to inoculate them with the fungi that they like to grow with. Particularly useful if you're doing trees and you want to avoid things like the dreaded honey fungus. Say, for instance, I was going to inoculate some oak tree, like this one here. What I would do would be to go and get the mushrooms that I would like it to grow with. So chanterelles, porcini, but it doesn't have to be just edible ones. It could be any of the ones that particularly like to grow with oak, you know, oak boletes. And you get a mushroom that hasn't completely opened out so that the spores are still in it. You know, once they're completely opened out, then the spores have been dropped. And you put it in a liquidizer with a litre of water and a tiny pinch of salt and a slightly bigger pinch of like molasses or dark brown unrefined sugar, and then just whiz the whole lot up.
Why the salt and sugar?
Because it creates a growing medium.
Okay, right.
You know, when you think of it, most things, if you think of the sap of trees, they have lots of salts and ions and sugars in them. You think of our, you know, blood plasma. It's like the liquid that comes out in the middle of a coconut. That's the closest natural thing to human plasma. So you're creating a sort of plasma, a fluid that's got a little bit of nutrients in it.
Okay.
And then you leave it for 24 hours, and that allows the spores to germinate and to start looking for a mate. But you don't want to leave it too long, because otherwise it'll all start to ferment and go off. And then you just go and water the trees that you want to grow with it, or dip the saplings in that you're planting out.
I've never heard of that before. That's fascinating.
All right. Once they've got a mycorrhizal association with the fungi they like growing with, they're less likely to get things like honey fungus.
Okay.
There is a school of thought now that thinks that honey fungus gets in by pretending to be other species. Because they're all talking to each other.
Yes. Yes, that I had heard.
These are young elderberry trees here. Elderberry is one of those plants where you can just cut off any of the long suckers that grow off the main stem and push them into the ground and they'll start growing.
Okay.
So these are only about, it's about their second year now.
When you come out to a patch of ground like this and you are foraging for whatever, I mean, aside from what it is you're hunting for, what do you get out of it? What does it do for you?
De-stresses, clears your mind. That's the interesting thing about foraging, is that I suppose because we've been doing it for so long. I mean, I think it's about 1.5 million years since we lit the first barbecue and invited our friends round. And only about, you know, 12,000 years that we started farming. So we've been foraging for an incredibly long time. So if it's not in our genes, it's certainly in our epigenetics, all the post-it notes that tell our genes what to do. And you'll notice that, you know, even when people go into supermarkets and things, there's a certain amount of foraging behaviour. Look how excited people get around, you know, the sale bins and other things like that. You know, that process of looking for things and discovering. And when you're out in the woods or the fields and you have intent, you know, looking for something, you become totally wrapped up in that. That's all you see. So it's both very, very intensely focused, but also very relaxing at the same time.
Quite childlike.
Very childlike. I think you enter something which we call liminal space, where time stops existing. Mm-hmm. You know, I've taken people out before, and at the end of it, they go, oh, my goodness. You know, I lost track of time. I stopped thinking about my mobile phone and my notifications and whether there was an email and what I had to do next. I just lost track of time. And you see, people do look like children again. You know, sometimes I do these sort of longer retreats where, you know, I encourage people to just leave their phone. And 3 days later, you know, when they're all saying goodbye, you know, they've all arrived sort of all looking a little bit frowned and worried and crumpled up and attached to their phones. And after 3 days, they've all got 10 years taken off them. They look like kids again. You know, we've forgotten how to play, how to just be. Inging, I call it. Let's go through here.
Inging.
Inging. Yes, being, doing, thinking, walking, inging.
Inging, yeah.
Monica Wilder, I did like that phrase, inging. You know, walking, inging. Thinking, being, doing, all those, you know, sort of active words.
Sort of like cooking.
I'll take the hint. We've got the sausages here. I like this cooking tripod. I like the fact that it's adjustable. You should see Monica's kitchen. It's absolutely full of stuff. You know, stuff that she's gathered, stuff that she's dried, stuff that she is fermenting, stuff that she's pickling, you name it. You know, my eyes were out in stocks, just sort of going, what is that? What is that?
I made beer for the first time in years from first principles, you know, to the malt. The malt, it took all day to produce 6 pints of beer. Put it away, said, stick it away for 2 weeks. So I recommended putting it in the fridge before you tried it, but I thought it was pretty cold. Yeah. A whole kitchen full of freshly fermented beer. But
excellent.
Yeah. It was lovely, just something elemental that we're getting back to, using the hops, using the grains. It's wonderful.
Let's keep the theme of mycelium going. Musician and composer Hamish Napier has been researching the trees of the Gaelic alphabet for his forthcoming album, The Woods. Now, Helen spent some time exploring the pine forest of Rothiemurchus at Loch Inniland with him and found out that it's not only what's happening above the ground that fascinates Hamish, but the underworld as well.
As we're walking here around the loch, I just can't help but admire the trees as we go, because we're starting to come across some more.
There's some real crackers here.
There really are.
Yeah.
These are very old trees, but the branches and the shapes, it's just astonishing. How have you honoured our Scots pine, then?
Oh, I mean, gee whiz, it needs an album in itself, really, doesn't it? The Scots pine is a keystone species. In other words, it's got loads of animals and creatures and plants and lichens and everything that are dependent on it.
Yeah.
So it's amazing, you know, when you look at one, you go, well, that's going to be food for a pine marten, food for a squirrel. It's going to be a place where insects can live inside the bark. You've got algae and that joins up forces with a fungus to make lichen on it. You get all sorts of amazing things happening with them, and they're so elegant. You get long, straight ones, and you get these beautiful old ones with gnarled branches. And the smell is...
Oh, yeah, I think we might have to go and have a sniff. There's a nice one here. And the lichen, particularly at this time of year, in winter, the lichen's really outstanding, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, it's just, they're just beautiful trees. You see a brilliant old forest. What you want to see is a really great balance between heather and blaberries on the ground. Not too much heather and not too many blaberries. You just got a lovely kind of balance. And then also you want to see like what we're seeing over there, which is juniper.
Yeah.
Really slow growing and really precious. They always look a little bit kind of untidy, or so I used to think, but now I think they're brilliant. It's this massive sprawling green bush through the understory of the forest. There's sort of trees you maybe don't see a lot of in the forest, things like elm. Used to see these more in the forests originally, and these trees like elm are reliant on trees like birch to pioneer over open spaces and then give them the shelter they need to eventually grow. So it's funny that sometimes you can look at the whole thing of the trees are at war with one another, but you can also look at it like they work together as well.
Yeah, so there's symbiotic relationships all the time within the forest.
Yeah, that's right. One of the coolest ones that I've come across is the mycorrhiza, these relationships you get between the fungus under the ground and the root tips of the trees. It's underneath the ground are the miles of this mycelium, these massive networks that are the fungus. On the top, you just see like a little fly agaric mushroom, you know, the red and white one.
Yes.
And you go, oh, look at that little mushroom there. Yeah. You're pointing at it, but you're probably already standing on it because it's all around you for metres around. This mushroom's under the ground and it'll connect up with a birch tree and up to the tips of its roots. They're doing more and more research into how trees actually communicate with each other, and it's fascinating because when a tree is under attack from beetles or whatever, sometimes you'll get certain trees will actually release a kind of tannin to make their needles not taste very nice. And so that's their kind of reaction to being under attack. And you find that trees will actually communicate under the ground via this kind of mycelial network. It's like a wood wide web of like information going, watch out, something's about to happen next to you. And it all happens quite fast for a tree. You think trees are living, you know, up to 500 years. Just if it only takes an hour to communicate with a tree next to you or less, it's pretty amazingly fast, rapid response, you know.
How have you tried to represent this whole underworld then in the forest?
One of the first pieces that I came up with for the woods was actually a piano piece. I was just sitting doodling at the piano and I came up with this this kind of piano accompaniment thing that's like broken chords, like finger picking on the guitar but played on the piano. And it kind of sounded like a wildlife documentary soundtrack. And I thought, oh, that definitely needs to go in there somewhere. So, and then over the top of that, I wrote a piece of music for the oak because it's one of the most important trees with mycorrhizal relationships with fungus under the ground. So you've got this understory of the fungus underneath the ground, and then you've got these beautiful trees above the ground. So that was the idea, the elegant strathspey above, which is the oak. For the oak tree, the Druids got their name from men of oak, and they're obviously very precious trees, and they're known as the tree of life, which is Dar in Gaelic. It's Darach in modern Gaelic. They're quite high up here, and they need richer soil and a bit more light, so south-facing slopes are good. So you see them in some of the south-facing slopes in Highland Glens, but mostly you see them over in the west coast, you know. So I wanted to write a tune that was like a strathspey, and it had a kind of dramatic minor feel to it, you know, kind of thinking about druids and this, you know, these kind of sacrificial places and the kind of drama associated with that. So it got a minor strathspey.
Hamish Napier there. You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors Podcast, coming to you today from the banks of the River Dee in Aberdeenshire.
Yeah, we're bringing you a special New Year programme to encourage you to embrace nature and the outdoors this year and thereby improve your life. It's not going to cost anything, but we're almost guaranteeing you can't take us to task. 12 months' time, if you follow even some of the things you'll hear today, I think you'll be a happier person.
I will go even further. You mean where we're standing at the moment, beside the river, that, you know, you've got big trees round about us. It doesn't need to be like this. You can go and do exactly the same thing in a park. You are retreating from the smoke because we've got the fire and we've got the sausages going, and it is actually quite blinding. And wherever we stand, the smoke's following us.
It's a bit spooky, that, isn't it?
It is, rather. If you miss any of this programme, or indeed you'd like to share it with somebody, you can catch us on BBC Sounds, or there's the internationally celebrated Scotland Outdoors podcast, enjoyed by discerning listeners around the world, which is definitely one to tell your friends about. You can find that on BBC Sounds and other places, wherever you get your podcast from.
Yeah, we regularly say this, we enjoy hearing about where you listen to the podcast. We really do. We've had folk from Kuwait, Spain, Switzerland, America, Vietnam. Just some recent examples. And you can also join in the conversation. Tell us, you know, it doesn't have to be the Scottish outdoors. It can be anywhere. It can be a desert. It can be a mountain. It can be a river. And you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, especially if nature's an important part of your culture, maybe like Native Americans or, as we heard earlier, with some of your African medicine.
Aye, quite. Well, you mean, connecting with nature, as I was saying earlier, it really doesn't need to be anything complicated or sophisticated. It can be as simple as going for a walk.
Well, I remember doing a programme years ago about traditional remedies. And this was so blind, obviously, when you think about it. The local doctor prescribed a man with depression as walk up Benahi one day every day for a month.
Yes.
It's nothing magical about it. Mm. It's being out there, it's exercising, it's detoxing. But when on that theme, Thomas Muller teaches courses in nature connection, really, at the Findhorn Foundation. And he gave me some top advice about how to get that connection.
So I would say the first thing that I would suggest you do and is walk slowly. Pay attention to what's in your environment in a totally relaxed way. In other words, don't have some idea of, all right, now I have to get something out of this, but actually just notice how your body feels. Okay, am I relaxed? Oh, I need to walk a little slower. How much am I noticing? Oh, my tension's super narrow. Let's just see if I can sort of expand it out more.
You're saying walking, I often stop and close my eyes or I'll even lie down.
Fantastic.
And just drink it in.
And you're raising a really important point, which is that everyone has their own style. And that's a very important point. Yeah, exactly. Whatever works for you to build that connection in yourself.
You do become suddenly aware, especially if you're lying down in the forest, or even a peat bog. Especially a peat bog, you get the movement, you hear the insects, you hear the wind. It's a different place.
Absolutely, yes. And I can see that you have a very deep connection yourself and you're describing like what works for you. And that's obviously the key for each one of us.
But I'm getting that lowered stress level at that point in time. Does it carry on if you're going back to the office to the computer?
Yeah, really good question again. It's like, well, you can cultivate the same way of being anywhere. I personally find it a little more difficult if I'm typing on a computer all day, but I'm also like finding ways to bring more of that connection with the plants on my desk even. You know, I'm finding ways to sort of sense into my body, take, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes if I feel a bit stressed, just to simply breathe, relax, connect with something, allow my senses to expand into my environment, things like that.
Does it become a bit addictive though? Do you need that fix more and more every day?
To me, it's me being a whole person. If I get very narrow and too focused on my inner mental voice or, you know, working on a computer, that's not the whole me. So I wouldn't say it's addictive. It's like cultivating wholeness in myself, actually.
But does it not mean you want to be outside rather than sitting at a computer?
I sense for myself when it's appropriate to be outside, and you know, sometimes I don't even pay attention, but I notice that when I do pay attention to that, actually I go about and everything just works way, way better for me.
Is that a difficult message to get out to folk in an office block or in a city?
I haven't really tried. I've been at the foundation for a while, but a lot of people come from, you know, London or other big cities here because they say, I really feel something is missing. And I know that I need more nature connection. So actually, they sense it for themselves. There's no need to be too loud about it, actually. But I would say that it's really important to do what you're doing and spread the word about how good this is for people.
But you're really spoiled. I mean, you're at Findhorn. It's a beautiful place. You're by the sea. You've got the forest. You're surrounded by, I would imagine, like-minded people. Do you kind of feel sorry for folk in the city?
There's rich opportunities in the city. I'm not going to like discount that either. You know, everyone has their own path. But like I said, this is, for me, this has brought so much wholeness and so much more richness to life that I'm really eager to share it. Absolutely. We had a recent online engagement here on collective trauma, and a lot of people were saying, I actually feel a lot of pain right now about what's going on in the environment. And I realize that I'm out of sync and my lifestyle is really contributing to part of the problem. And man, I just wish for those people that they would connect with nature for themselves, because I think that would actually give them the answers that would work for them.
Because there is that, as you brought up, that whole pressure on the very environment that's helped you de-stress.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And you know, as a species, as human beings, I would really, really love to see us develop and really value this relationship with nature, because I think we would start making different decisions. If politicians, and Lord knows they're probably just trying to do a good job, but I sense that a lot of them are sort of cut off from nature. How would you justify to your constituents in the present climate, I actually took a day to be in nature? I think they would make better decisions. I think they would sense within themselves the connection with nature and the importance. But, you know, that's a hard thing to say right now, just because of the culture we're living in.
Is there a good argument for having a parliament meeting outside? I mean, the Isle of Man, the parliament gathered round the small hill. That's where they did business.
That is a fantastic idea. I really think, you know, those people would, at least temporarily, feel different and sense the world in a different way. And I would love to see that affect their decision-making, because I think they would make it with this felt sense in themselves of, you know, being in connection with nature and valuing it. That's a fantastic idea.
Come back to full circle. I mean, it's obviously worked for you big time. Do you see changes in other people? Do you see them coming in hot-wired and then a year later?
Yes, absolutely. And they tell us this all the time. They say, I came here, you know, maybe I had some expectations, but man, this has given me so much more than I ever could have dreamt to be in nature and to be connecting in a deeper way. It's just opening up my senses and my personal life and my sense of who I am in ways that I could just never imagine, because I was kind of cut off from it living in the city.
Is there a better time of year to be outside? For me, I find the winter a really good time. The light seems to be more intense.
I mean, to be honest, living in this country, I'm so grateful that I get to experience Scotland, because it, you know, like rain and so on. Growing up in the US, I always thought of just being outside when it wasn't raining, when it was nice weather. And here I realize there's beauty in all of it. There's ways of connecting in all of it. So I'm just tremendously grateful. I don't think I even have a preference anymore. As long as I'm, you know, able to keep warm, then I'm in reasonably dry. I'm delighted to be out in whatever weather now.
One last one. How important is it to be alone in the woods? Because that's a bit that does it for me. I don't want to share that space with folk.
Yeah, no, I completely relate to that, actually. I go hiking solo now. Sometimes I go with groups, but I completely agree with you. It's a completely different experience. And I also feel a much deeper connection. I'm able to sort of get to a different place in myself when I'm alone.
Thomas Miller there from the Findhorn Foundation.
I'll be honest here. Thomas was a little bit wary of me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, understandably. But we kind of really, I got on really well with him, and especially when we kind of talked about being in the woods, lying on your back, just staring up into space. And my suggestion about maybe we should get the Scottish Parliament or the Westminster Parliament to meet outside. Mm-hmm. Like when we were in Isle of Man, the Manx Parliament met on a knoll in the hill. Yeah. And it's going to be great for anyone. What's could be on a summer's day, what a delight. And on a winter's day, focuses the mind. Yeah. So you're not going to have a waffle forever. You're going to get to the salient points and then get off the hill as quickly as you can. But I mean, what a great spot to have it, sitting by the river, mm-hmm. calming folk down. And imagine it's harder to get, you know, that adversarial thing, the House of Westminster,
yes.
Them and us. Because if you're in a circle round a fire beside a river, that's got to take it down.
Yeah. Well, you'd think so, but worth trying.
That coming together is a little bit different from where Thomas and I were, because I was saying, I really like getting it myself, and possibly don't want to share it. Mm-hmm. You take a different approach because you like sharing things with everybody.
Sometimes I, sometimes no. When you were talking about lying on your back and looking up at the sky, I mean, you know, I've got a proper astronomical telescope. I actually much prefer lying down on the ground on, you know, basically just a carry mat or something like that. You know, all the lights switched off, just in the dark, and just using the Mark One eyeball to enjoy the sky going over. I really like that. But you're right. I mean, sharing's good. You know, enjoying the outdoors with companions, or indeed a companion, can be really life-changing. Last year, I met two lovely folk, Addie and her daughter Athena, when they were in the midst of their pirate adventure along the Caledonian Canal. Now, what I liked about this is, you know, they're not roughy-tufty outdoor types necessarily, but they'd built the canoe themselves.
Yeah, they built it out of rubbish and cast-off, and they nearly broke it.
This is Icarus. It's amazing, isn't it?
This is fantastic.
So this is old church skirting here. This used to be someone's bed.
Right.
Can you imagine someone having a bed and then thinking, that's it, it's going to the skip. And little do they know that it's going to be an adventure vessel that will be exploring Scotland for one. God knows where else it's going to go. This was from someone's rubbish bin as well.
So you've got the webbing strap sitting on top of that, so that's quite comfortable to sit on.
It is really comfortable. What do you think, Athena? Yeah.
Reasonably comfortable?
Yeah.
Right. This is your mum's fourth trip. Have you been on the previous three?
Yes.
Okay, where did you go?
Leeds, Liverpool, the Grand Union, mm-hmm. and Lancaster.
So you're on the Caledonian Canal now.
Yes.
How does this compare with the other three canals?
Easier. Way easier.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Because this is a boat, and the others weren't really boats.
What were they then?
Rafts and...
Just...
Yeah.
Piles of stuff that happened to float.
Yes.
What's your day job when you're not being an occasional annual pirate?
I work for the University of Leeds in the management team.
Do they know about this?
All they know about this, they're part of this.
Oh, really? Okay.
So the beauty of the university is, the way I see it, is all these geniuses work together in all these incredible fields that I feel very strongly about. All I have to do is just pick a concept, an idea, and go find someone who I like to call a dream builder, will believe in this dream and will want to be part of it. So there's a network called the Water Leeds Network at the university. So it's all the scientists from everywhere across the university that do some kind of research related to water. So it could be from the earth and environment, from mechanical engineering, all these different areas, but water is their thing. And so last year I presented the Pirates of the Canals, and I said, what I would really like to do is for my next project, because I said, obviously, this is a sequence and I would like to see a lot more pirate adventures. I would like to build a raft and I would like it to have some kind of environmental impact where we research or we contribute to your research. And again, it goes to show that you never stop learning.
Yeah.
And you can be part of something bigger. So I actually got a few emails from people saying, you know, let's do something together. And it led to this. So we built the boat and I said, you know, teach us all you know about invasive species and what we find along the canal. We'll try to identify those.
Tell me about the umbrella.
Oh my God, we love the umbrella. Athena, you tell Mark about the umbrella.
How good's the umbrella?
Very. So when it's windy, we put it up, I hold it at the front and no one needs to paddle.
Seriously, you can use it as a sail?
Yeah.
We've never done this before, but we thought
it would work
it's possible.
Well
it did work very well. Uh-huh. We have never done 10K as fast as this, have we, Athena?
No.
We were amazed that we made it here. We said, this is it. That's it. That's done. We were really shocked because you see how heavy this gear is. And it just, it blew us down here in no time.
What's your intention? I mean, are you going to be doing 10K a day to where and then what?
It's not 10K, so today was one of the shortest, wasn't it, Athena?
Second shortest.
Yeah, and then there's other days that Athena looked at the map. She's the logical mind and she's the planner. And she was saying, Mummy, did you know this day we're doing 26 kilometres? That day
That's
we're doing...
That's the most, though.
Yes.
26.
We might need two umbrellas.
We did think about that. So different days is different distances, but we're thinking, why not just get to Inverness, sailing in style, and then, since we're there, and we've got another 5 days before school starts, we should probably come back again and try find the most practical way to get to the car in the most energy-efficient way.
I think this is just genius. Just genius. Lost in admiration for this entire thing. I think it's a brilliant plan. Absolutely brilliant.
We're used to people saying, this is crazy,
you know,
this is not going to work out. And then we get the other, say, 80, 90% of people who are very enthusiastic like yourself. And they go, this is amazing. And what's even more fantastic is when people actually write you an email or they drop you a text and they say, you know what, I took my kid out today on a boat because I was inspired by what you did. We didn't do such a great distance, but we still did a small segment. And I thought, this is what it's about. It is about inspiring people. And inspiration really is that simple. It's just seeing something and saying, I can do that. And what I try to highlight is, look at us. I mean, we don't exactly look like the most sporty people out there, right? But if we can, and size and age is clearly not an issue, then everybody should at least try to do something that excites them, something that makes them feel young and playful. And this is a playful project, but with purpose, with meaning.
Addy and Athena on the Caledonian Canal at Gerlochy, and Addy very kindly sent me some photographs of that encounter sometime afterwards, because we helped them basically portage their boat up to where the campsite was, because we talked to them quite some distance away from the campsite. I'm not a great fan of photographs of me. I don't like photographs of me. But she took one photograph of me in that wee boat, and I just looked so happy. I've got this big, stupid grin on my face.
You also look huge compared to it.
They are quite wee.
Sky blue boat. It looked a bit flimsy, and we were just at the bottom of the lock, and they had a kind of an 8 to 10 mile paddle up that lock in quite worrying conditions.
Well, I told Addy that, you know, we had so much feedback after that transmission that, you know, so many people said, wish I could do that. You know, it's inspired me to go out and try this. So I won't do it in the same scale as that, but I am going to do something, you know, and it's
why not? Just give it a go. Let's go back to herbalist Monica Wild. She's somebody who lives very, very close to her natural environment all year round. She is getting as much goodness out of the land as she can, not just in terms of food, but in terms of medicine too. Just the sheer process of being outside and trying to gather this stuff does her a power of good, she says. Is there anything worth picking, however, in deepest, darkest winter?
Look, there's a few last crab apples left over there.
Ah, yeah. Clock them now.
Of course, we've had so much rain recently.
Oh, it's been torrential.
It's been torrential, so a lot of them are rotting.
Yeah.
Rotting on this. Makes the best country wine.
Does it, would you?
It does. Okay. Very nice country.
We started off in your kitchen, which is absolute. No, no, not at all. Not at all. It's absolutely fabulous. There's so many jars and potions and stuff hanging from the roof and, you know, stuff drying. And you think, what's that? There's a lot of stuff in there.
Yes. Well, we don't buy a lot of things from the supermarket.
Uh-huh.
You know, olive oil, cat food. Cat food's not for me.
Yeah.
Everything we cook, we do from scratch. And just once a week, we go and pick up a box of organic vegetables. And then a lot of it, even in the middle of winter, a lot of it still comes off the land. There's still mushrooms around. I mean, there won't be today because we've had such torrential rain the last few days. But if it stays dry for a couple of days, the oysters will come back out again. Oyster mushrooms will come back out again. There'll be porcelain fungus going all the way through the winter. Velvet shanks were just coming out before the rain. There'll be jelly ears. There might be a few of the wood bluets still. You know, there's still enough out there to live off. I've picked oyster mushrooms on Christmas Day before. And then a lot of people think that, you know, plants don't come out till the spring. Well, farmed vegetables might not. But as soon as you get, I mean, when you look at it around here now, everything's died back. Everything's looking a bit dead and died back. But that means that a lot of the plants that were more aggressively growing during the summer, like the buttercups, the nettles, the docks, the thistles, they've died back. And there's a lot of plants that take this opportunity that to start growing now. Mm-hmm. I bet we could find some.
Go on then. Crack on. You set yourself a challenge and we'll put you to it.
Have a little look. What have we got?
There's a wee burn here.
There's a wee burn. It's a sorrel leaf.
Okay. Right. Can I eat it?
Yes.
Okay. I just don't like the way you grin at me when I hear it. Yeah, of course you can. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Lemony.
Yeah, slightly vinegary tang.
Apple, yeah. Lemon.
So it's interesting. I wouldn't have thought that was the shape of a sorrel leaf. Well, is that different from wood sorrel?
That's different to wood sorrel,
okay,
yes.
Okay, right.
It's a member of the dock family.
Mm-hmm.
Look down here. See, it's all just taking its opportunity. And, you know, where you find sheltered little warmer patches, you'll find more things going on as well. I'm sure I saw a dandelion. Yes, look, there's a dandelion leaf over there.
Mm-hmm.
You can, that will substitute for rocket in a salad.
I find this fascinating because at the risk of offending you, you live in a world of food. You live in a world of medicine. It's all round you. But effectively, you know, 300 years ago, you would have been the wise woman of the woods if you survived the experience. But
the ducking pond.
Yeah, we're saying, and if she floats. No, but what I'm getting at here is that not everybody can do this. Not everybody has this kind of facility. Not everyone could live this kind of life.
You know, that's choice. You know, I used to live in a city with three kids, driving to a job, you know, every day and back. You know, I've done that as well. But there was a point at which I chose, you know, to get out. I mean, in terms of where I live now, you know, I slept in a caravan for 2.5 years and cooked out of a shed, a small wooden shed, you know, to be able to build a house, because I couldn't have afforded to do it otherwise. You know, around the country, you'll find that more and more young people are starting to convert vans to try to reconnect with nature. There's this huge hunger amongst people to reconnect. As I said, you know, 1.5 million years of doing it one way, even if you don't know that's what you want, that's a draw. You know, people are interested in, you know, organic food, in going out in the countryside, in going out for walks, in learning the old traditions again.
When I started teaching foraging 15 years ago, could be 20, I don't know, time just stretches into an infinite thing. Every year people would say, well, you know, that seems to be going well. Do you think it's just a fad? Do you think it's just a phase? And I'm still waiting for it to stop being a fad or a phase. You know, year after year, people are interested. 5 years ago, Mark Williams at Galloway Wild Foods and I were part of a small group that set up an organisation for people who were teaching foraging. And the five of us grew into 23, and now there's about over 140. You know, at one stage, there were only two of us visibly teaching in Scotland. You know, now if you look at the Association of Foragers website, you know, there's a whole load of people. And forest school, and forest bathing, and eco-yoga. You know, our need to be part of nature isn't going to go away, because we are part, and we become detached from nature at our peril.
Somebody's listening to this and they think, yeah, that's all very well and good for Monica, you know, she's got away with that kind of thing. I can't do this because ... you know, fill in whatever I actually want. What would you say to them?
We have the right to roam in Scotland. We have incredible access to wild spaces. Everybody can get out. Everybody can go for a walk. And people do. I was reading an interesting study about health in green spaces where they did a sort of stress survey in Glasgow. And when guys are feeling stress, if they go out for a walk, even if it's just walking the dog, if they go out for a walk to relieve stress, as opposed to just, you know, get a beer and turn up the telly or whatever, they reduce their incidence of heart attack and live X amount of years longer. I can't remember. There's an immeasurable health benefit there. But this was people in the middle of the city centre in Glasgow. There's a lot of green space. And you can, you know, you can get out.
Monica Wild there. And, you know, having just met her, I want to go back in the summertime. I want to go back in the summertime when this, she says it's like a jungle. The place just blows up, essentially. There is food, there is medicine everywhere. And just pick her brains further, because I've really got the feeling. I spoke to her for about, I don't know, unusually long. And I only scratched the surface. There's just so much in there. There is a long tradition in Strathspey of landowners commissioning music from local composers. Give you an example. Angus Cumming was fiddler and piper for Sir James Grant of Grant, whose collection of Strathspeys was published somewhere in the 18th century. Now, there are countless others. Hamish Napier is continuing in that tradition. His forthcoming album, The Woods, is being supported by a different sort of land manager, Cairngorms Connect. They're a partnership organisation involving land managers with the aim of enhancing the habitat biodiversity of the Cairngorms National Park. Now, Hamish, as we've already heard, is honing in on the trees around Strathspey. So let's just start off with his musical treatment for the elder.
One of the tunes is called The Boor Tree, which is an old name for the elder, because elder, inside each twig, it's got a kind of wee pithy stuff in the centre of each twig that you can bore out. And they say that the fairies used to make their bagpipes out of them, but they used to make instruments and whistles and kids' pea shooters out of them and all that kind of stuff. So I thought, I'm going to write a tune that's got this kind of magical quality to it, this kind of magical sort of dance to it, that's got that kind of sound of, if you imagine a party of fairies. We're at Whitewell, and this is a great spot just above Rothie Merkis. So this is where you would go to park the car if you're going up Braeria, which is on the other side of the Larrigrue from Cairngorm. Also, if you're going to walk up Gleneinich, because this is where some of the really old wild woods are, and you really notice it, the difference between a more sort of park-like wood, which you might get around about Grantnonspey and Angoch Woods, where you get lots of trees roughly the same size. Here you've got loads of trees of different sizes and different ages. You've got loads of these hummocks everywhere, old anthills and old pine stumps. It's one of the sort of wilder parts of the Cairngorms Connect area. It's absolutely beautiful. It's so peaceful, you can kind of go off the beaten tracks and just find yourself right in the middle of a really deep wood. It's totally amazing.
I just love the sense of adventure it brings, actually, just even to be here, because I've been up Gleneinich and to Braeria from this end, and that's where you're entering true wilderness, I suppose, on the Cairngorm Plateau. But this is just at the edge. This is like the welcoming part here.
And there's a great story about Gleneinich, actually. It's a story of a very famous tree, the tree of returning at Cruachan Chile. a lot of old Highlanders would have used big pine trees in prominent places as landmarks, and they would have been, they would have said, oh, we're just going to head up to the Tree of Return. And that was a tree which was far up the glen towards the tree line. When they were taking their cattle up there to graze in the summer, they could take the cattle up to a certain point and then just send them on the way, and the cattle would know to go right up into the glen by themselves and go to the pastures high up in midsummer. And that would mean that the shepherds didn't have to walk all the way, and they could just return back down to their shielings at the bottom. I love that idea of that, you know, where we might use, oh, just turn left at the church, or, yeah. You know, when you get to the railway station, turn right. It's like, oh, when you get to the Tree of Return, you've got to, you know, yeah. It's that idea, like, these were markers for people. And it's just one of the many, many things about our cultural connection with trees and the landscape, and how, you know, I hope that maybe one day we'll start to kind of regain these a little bit more. Not just, that's not just a tree, that's a tree with a bit of a history, it's a bit of a celebrity.
Yeah, you know? But if you think about it, that I'm sure animals, all the wildlife here, you see the deer tracks and so on, that's how they navigate. They must know the trees intimately. And
yeah, you get little deer tracks that they always use and
choose to meet in places, and certain places are good for lying down and so on and so on.
Well, we can have a wee, we can head through here along to what's known as Piccadilly Circus.
Yeah.
The elm tree is a tree which is associated with, it's called the Tree of the Underworld, and it's associated with death and mourning. It's kind of got this gloomy feel to it, and apparently sometimes elm branches would fall off and land on people. But they are wonderful trees and they support loads of different wildlife. I found this story in Elizabeth Grant's Memoirs of a Highland Lady, and it really made me stop my tracks. I've got one of the first edition of this book. Around here in the forests of Strathspey, a lot of the pine woods were cut down and floated down the River Spey in rafts and floated down to Garmouth at the mouth of the Spey, and they were made into ships. I think there was a couple of ships that fought at the Battle of Trafalgar that were spey-built ships. But they also were used for pit props and in the mines during the war and all sorts of things. Apparently, in London, they even found hollowed-out pine trunks from Glenmore Forest that were used as sewage pipes. So one of the things they would do is they would transport the wood quite often just down the tributaries to the Spey, like the River Druy here. So they would actually float the logs down the river. They have a wee loch dam at the top with some sluice gates, and they would open the sluice gates just at dawn, and then you'd get this flood of water coming down. And then suddenly, like, everybody would spring into action. You'd have people moving the logs. You'd have a team of a dozen or so men with really long, long sticks that they would use to, with a hook on the end that they would use to control the logs. And then they'd have, like, loads of young teenagers at the front that were helping to prevent the log jams and pushing things out of the way. So it was a real spectacle. They called it doing a log run or doing a run. One of the jobs was getting sent up the glen to Glen Einnig there to open the sluice gate. And this is a story about young Alan. A quantity of timber being wanted at Dree Mouth for the Spey floaters who'd come up to make their rafts, a run was determined on, and this lad was sent up to the glen to open the sluice. It was a wild night, wind and hail changing to snow, and he had 11 or 12 miles to go through the forest, full of paths and across the heath that was trackless. Poor old Christie. She gave him a hot supper, put up a bannock and a little whisky for him, and wrapped his plaid well around him. She looked after him as he left the house in the driving sleet. Such risks were common. No one thought about them. Early in the morning down came the water. The weather had taken up and the floating went merrily on. But Alan did not return. He'd reached the loch, that was plain. But then, where had he wandered? Not far. When the evening came on and no word of him, a party set out in search and they found him at his post. Asleep seemingly. A bit of a bannock and the empty flask beside him. He had done his duty, opened the water gate, and then sat down to rest. The whiskey and the storm told the remainder. He was quite dead.
Mm-hmm.
Hamish Napier there, and the launch of his album The Woods will take place at Celtic Connections on the 19th of January when he'll be performing at the Mitchell Theatre in Glasgow.
I just love all that mixing up of trees and folklore, you know, the fairies making
bagpipes of elder and things.
This stuff, Helen, just explain what this is.
This is something I've brought for you as a wee New Year drink.
It's not what we think it is it?
It's not whiskey.
No.
It's in a whiskey bottle. Okay. Recycled.
It's got leaves in it.
It is called Beech Leaf Noyau.
Noyau.
Something like that. It's French. And in the spring, I picked a whole bunch of beech leaves from down here.
Mm-hmm.
And
very
you
sweet.
Leave it in gin.
Gin.
And sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what it makes.
You get that tannin off it.
Hey, I like that.
Perfect for a winter's day, though.
That is really tasty. Well done, you.
Well, it's one of those things. It's like... you always say that jam, strawberry jam, just gives you a taste of spring and summer in the winter. And for me, that brings a taste of spring in the winter. Have it by the fire outside and remember the trees when they were in
bloom. A bit of
rowan
jelly as well with your New Year meal. I'm also impressed that you haven't burned the sausages.
Give me time.
We turned over a New Year leaf here. And that's it for the Scotland Outdoors podcast for... the first programme in the year. You're still knocking back the gin, quite enjoying it.
I like that stuff.
If you've got a New Year tradition that you want to share with the rest of the group, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. But until then, from all of us here, bye-bye.